I want us tonight to talk about another one of God's messengers in the Old Testament, and I want us to talk about Elijah. We know a lot of things about Elijah, and I think it's interesting as you look at Luke chapter, the passage that was read from the book of Luke that tells us about the transfiguration of. Have you ever wondered why Elijah was there? Why is it that of all the Old Testament characters, that all of a sudden in the transfiguration of Jesus, Elijah is there? Now we'll answer that question a little bit later tonight, but at least we'll give at least a possible answer to that. Why was not David there, the man who was a man after God's own heart? Why would you not have Isaiah, the messianic prophet, there? Why is it that these two characters are there? And of course you know that story, and the whole lesson tonight very little centers around that. But there they were on that Mount of Transfiguration. And you remember the request that Peter made, that or suggestion they made, let's build three tabernacles here, one for you, Lord, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah. And evidently, God was not happy about that, because there was that cloud that overshadowed them. And then all of a sudden, Moses and Elijah were not there anymore. Only Jesus was there. Now, as you think about Moses as God's messenger, here's the outline of tonight's sermon, just so you'll be able to know where we're going to go. We're going to talk about Elijah as being the first of the prophets, and look at the word first, it's in quotation marks, because that's an accommodative way of saying that, but there is a sense in which he was the first of the prophets. Then we'll talk about that incident in his life in which he was called the man who's causing trouble in Israel, the troubler of Israel. And then we'll look at the man, as James described him, a man of like passions. Now, understand, if you've got the New King James, the New King James is not going to say like passion. I just love the old King James sometime. And so whenever James says Elijah was a man of like passion as we are, we want to be talking about that. And then we want to talk about that time when Elijah was taken up into heaven, the fact that Elijah was the forerunner of Jesus. And look at the word heaven in quotation marks and the word forerunner in quotation marks, because, and there's a reason for all of that. It's an accommodative way of using that that kind of language. But first, let's talk about Elijah as the first of the prophets. Now, in what sense is Elijah the first prophet? Let me ask you this. You can speak out loud if you want to, and tell me who was the first man in the Bible called a prophet. I've gone deaf. You know who it is? I think you'd be rather amazed. Abraham is the first man in the Bible that's called a prophet. I find that truly amazing. And so it's not in that sense that we think about Elijah as being the first prophet. It's not in that sense. Well, in what sense are we talking about Elijah as being the first prophet? Well, he is not the first man that prophesied. Now, if I were to ask you, who's the first man that prophesied in the Bible, who would you think of? Well, you might think of Noah. You know, you might think of the fact that Noah was called a preacher of righteousness, and since Noah did not have a Bible, that is in that sense that God had to give him a message, and in that sense he would have been a prophet. But are you aware there's a man in the Bible that prophesied before Noah? You got to look deep in your head to find this one. Enoch. Enoch prophesied. Now, you don't read that in Genesis, by the way. You got to go over to the book of Jude, where Enoch is called the seventh from Adam, and then there's a quotation from Enoch's prophecy that the Lord was going to come with 10,000 of his saints. And so Enoch is the first man in the Bible that prophesied. Well, in what sense then do we think about Elijah being the first of the prophets? Well, if we'll sort of think about the outline of the Old Testament, the Israelites, they come out of the land of Egypt, they go down to the wilderness, they come into the promised land, and there the messengers of God or the priest, or there's Moses or Aaron, and then they get into the promised land, and they're the priest, and they're the priest that are there teaching people the messages of God. And I'm not saying there were not prophets there. Peter in Acts chapter 3 talks about Samuel and all the prophets after him. But there, you arrive at that point in the Bible when all of a sudden there's a multitude of prophets. Who's the first of them? who is before Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Daniel and Hosea and Joel and Amos and Obadiah and Jonah and Micah? Who's before all of those? And why is it that anybody should listen? Why should anybody listen to Isaiah? Why should anybody listen to Jeremiah? How many miracles did they do? You stop and think about it. How many miracles, do we know about, how many miracles did Hosea do? How many miracles did Joel do? Then why should anybody listen to those prophets? And in my perception of the Bible, and understand this is Dan's perception, and that's all that it is, but if you come to the New Testament age, there were many prophets in the New Testament age, but not every prophet in the New Testament performed miracles. There was the gift of prophecy, and then there was the gift of miracles. And so here's a man that did a miracle, but the purpose of his miracle was not just for everybody to say, "Wow, did you see what happened?" The purpose of the miracles was to authenticate the message that was being delivered by the prophets. And so God was ready, as he was dealing with the Jews and to speak to the fathers by the prophets and to bring this great multitude of prophets onto the scene, God brought two individuals. Elijah did 7 miracles. Elisha, who asked for a double portion of the spirit of Elijah, he did 14 miracles. And that's interesting, since he asked that I might have a double portion of the spirit of Elijah. And so whenever God is ready now to start sending prophet after prophet after prophet, God provided two individuals, Elijah and Elisha, to authenticate the office of those who were prophets. And so we've got a whole list of verses here, and we're not going to spend a lot of time looking at them, but look at 1 Kings chapter 20, verse 35. There's a certain man that is there of the sons of the prophets. And now all of a sudden you start reading about these groups of prophets. And then the next slide from 2 Kings chapter 2. And you see how many times in verse 3 and 5 and 7 and 15, 3, 5, 7 and 15 of 1 Kings chapter 2, you start reading about these sons of the prophets. And so there are those who believe that there were a group of individuals who were recognized as prophets. In fact, some have indicated that perhaps the Hebrew word even had the concept of the school of the prophets. And that being as it may, whether that is the case or not, there were just a group of individuals called the sons of the prophets. And so when you get to 2 Kings chapter 4, you run across it again in verse 1, in 2 Kings chapter 4 and verse 38, and 2 Kings chapter 5 and verse 22, and 2 Kings chapter 6 and verse 1, You keep running, you run across all of these individuals that are called the sons of the prophet. In fact, in one of the verses, and I'm not sure which one it is, maybe you can look up there and find it, there are 50 of them that are mentioned as a number of them. There was a multitude of them. Well now, why should anybody listen to these prophets? You ought to listen to a prophet because he's speaking for God. How can you know he's speaking for God? And the answer is by the miracles that they do. So it's very likely that Elijah was the first of the prophets in this sense, that through Elijah and Elisha, the office of being a prophet was authenticated by the miracles that they did. Pretty interesting, isn't it? I mean, you start and think about all the things that transpired in their lives, and now there's a purpose for that. What's this matter about him being the troubler? Elijah, the troubler of Israel. Well, to understand that, you've got to understand of the confrontation there was between Ahab and Jezebel. You get over in 1 Kings chapter 17, and there is that story about the prophets of Baal. You remember how many of them that were there? Likely there were 850. You read about a group of 400 and then a group of 450. In fact, what you read of in that same chapter is the fact that Jezebel had killed all the prophets. She tried to kill all the prophets. And an unknown, a remarkable character there by the name of Obadiah. All of a sudden he said, "I hid 50 of them," or was it 100 of them? "I hid in a cave. When Jezebel was trying to kill all of these individuals, I was out taking care of the prophets." Now it is interesting, by the way, that a little bit later after this event up at Mount Carmel, where they had the contest between the prophets of Baal and between Elijah as to which God would send down fire from the heavens, that Elijah went away as depressed as he could be, saying, I'm the only righteous man left on this earth. Why? Because Jezebel and Ahab done everything they could to destroy all of the prophets and every semblance of God that was there. And so it's on that occasion where there is that famine that comes onto the land. The Bible talks about the fact that Elijah prayed, and the judgment of God was brought against Ahab and Jezebel, and there was a famine that lasted for 3.5 years. Can you imagine what it would be like if it did not rain for 3.5 years? Folks in Florida get upset if you can't water your grass every 3.5 days. Can you imagine what it would have been like when there was no rain throughout all of that nation for 3.5 years? How'd that come about? It came about as a result of evil Ahab and wicked Jezebel and the fact that God was bringing judgment. And Elijah is the one who is there to confront Ahab and Jezebel again and again. In fact, the situation regarding Naboth's vineyard is a confrontation between Elijah and Ahab and Jezebel and the things that are transpiring in that story. Now, here's the interesting thing. We don't talk about that widow of Zarephath that we talked about in that sermon this morning, that Gentile lady where Elijah went up and the oil and the flour, the meal that she had there to make that cake, that final cake for her son and for herself to have one meal before they died, and then it was all over. That's when all of this happened. Elijah first goes out by that brook Kidron. And out there by the brook, you remember how he was fed? Yeah. You know, the ravens brought him food. Well, how on earth could a raven bring that much food? You've got to listen carefully because I'm going to make a play on words. Well, they brought it one peck at a time. And so if you'll stop and think about it, they brought all of this food over there for them. Don't groan, all right? They brought all of this food for Elijah. And then finally the brook dried up. And that's when Elijah leaves Israel and goes up above Naphtali, up in what's modern-day Phoenicia, up in Syria, up in that part of the world. And that's where that widow is taken care of. Finally, after 3.5 years, God tells Elijah, you go back down. Go back down and confront Ahab. And there's an interesting thing about that. When finally it works out that Ahab confronts Elijah, he comes to Elijah and he says, Elijah, we probably ought to talk about this Ahab, Jezebel, and the prophets. I guess we've talked enough about that, but that's that contest there at Mount Carmel, and that's just evidence of that. But finally, there is that accusation that is brought against Elijah. When Ahab sees Elijah, look at this passage here where the Bible said, when Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, you troublemaker, you troublemaker. Has that ever happened to you? What, Ahab, look at the mess that you've made here in this land. It's all your fault. And I love verse 18 of this chapter where Elijah says, I'm not the one who's troubled Israel. It's you, King Ahab, that's causing the trouble. Now, you get in trouble a lot of times, don't you? Just trying to live right and do right. You ever have a religious discussion with an in-law and they said, don't you talk to me about the Bible? You ever been in the workplace and they said, nope, don't want to talk about the Bible? I wish you wouldn't bring it up. You're just causing all this, you're just making a real big mess out of all of this. You see, the reality is the troubler of Israel was not the guy that was trying to do right, it was a guy that was doing wrong. And in your life, whenever there's all that peer pressure, everybody's trying to get you to do wrong. And you have to stand up and say, I'm not going to do that. And everybody in the classroom says, you know, gets upset at you because you're trying to do what's right and everything. They may even laugh at you. And they think, if you just keep your mouth shut, everything will be at peace. No. The troubler is never those who are doing right. And that's really, really an important point for us to learn as we think about what is involved in reference to Elijah. Now in James chapter 5, James describes Moses, or pardon, describes Elijah as a man of like passion as us. A man of like passion as us. What does that mean? Well, you begin to look at the verse, and you see James uses that. And here's the way James: confess your trespasses one to another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Elijah was a man with a nature like ours. That's the New King James for the like passion of the Old Testament. And he prayed earnestly that it would not rain. And it did not rain on the earth for 3 years and 6 months. And he prayed again, and the earth gave rain, and the earth produced fruit. You really feel like Elijah? When he's up there standing up against the prophets of Baal, can you identify with that? I'm sure you've stood up against 850 people or 450 prophets of Baal a lot of times in your life. No, I don't think so. You know, have you ever prayed and had this kind of an impact on the world? No. Well, what about that time when Elijah is headed down after he has that confrontation with those prophets of Baal? And you remember he leaves and goes down to Mount Sinai, and he says, "I'm the only righteous folks left on this earth." When I think about being like Elijah, a man of like passion with Elijah, I identify a whole lot more with that than I can some of these other heroic things that he did. But I want you to stop and think about it for a moment. You understand what this verse says about the power of prayer? You see, this not raining, now listen carefully, not raining for 3 years and 6 months is not a miracle. It's an answer to prayer. And we've got to get that distinction in our mind. Because a miracle is when God sets aside the laws of nature, you know, it's God working, and please don't misunderstand me. But you see, if this is a miracle, then all of a sudden, I don't have this kind of power in prayer. But look back at verse 16. Verse 16 says, pray for one another, because the effectual, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. And the illustration of the power of a righteous man is Elijah. You and I need to understand that as God worked through Elijah in this instance, this very event in the life of Elijah is an event that is used to illustrate the fact that we ought to be praying and that God will work through us because, and here's the whole point, because He's just like we are. It's not that He had miraculous power. That's not the point. The point is not that He had some miraculous power, you know, to stop the rain. It is that whenever He prayed, God did some things. And I want you to reflect about it for just a moment. I want you to think back in the last 4 or 5 years in the history of this church of individuals who were dying. And we prayed as a church, and they didn't die. You think that family prayer makes any difference? Ones we have on Wednesday night. If they don't make any difference, let's quit doing it. But I'm telling you, if I'm sick or one of my loved ones is sick, I want you to be praying for me. Because I believe with all of my heart that the effectual, fervent prayer of the righteous avails much. Now, if you're not righteous, don't need to pray. But I want you to pray for me. And that's the whole point that God is trying to make in reference to this man, that he prayed, and then when he prayed again, it did rain. And the fact that it started raining again is God just using the laws of nature. It's not a miracle that it started raining again. God just used the laws of nature that were in place to bring all of that about. And I say that because of the difficulty that some people have in understanding what a miracle is. See if I can illustrate. When David killed Goliath, was that a miracle? No. Was that God working? Absolutely. Now, if David had thrown that rock to the west and had gone out and done the boomerang and come back toward the east and hit the giant in a way that violates the laws of nature, that's a miracle. Every healing there is divine healing. But there's that instantaneous raising of people from the dead that ignores the laws of nature regarding death and brings that individual back alive again. That's the distinction that we need to make. But let's not get locked up in that so much as to hear what James 5 is saying. Folks, you ought to pray. You ought to pray for one another because it'll make a difference. You ought to pray for your marriage. You ought to pray for your children. You ought to pray for this nation because it'll make a difference. And for sure, you ought to pray for this church. I covet the prayers of this church for my eldership. And I covet the prayers of this church for those men who are deacons. And I covet the prayers of this church for those of us who preach with this church. Why? Because it makes a difference. It makes a difference. And we need to understand that. And that's exactly what James is trying to say when he said, he's a man of like passions with us. Let's talk about that time whenever he was taken into heaven. I put that in quotation marks because John chapter 3, Jesus says, nobody's ascended into heaven. Well, where'd Elijah go? Well, he went up into the heavens. But James chapter 3 said he didn't go into the very presence where Jesus went because John says nobody has ever ascended into the heaven except Jesus, the Son of God. And so as Elijah went up, Elijah did not go into the heaven. But Elijah is one of the two men in the Bible who did not die. You know the other one? He was a prophet. He was the first man who prophesied. That give you a clue? I hope you were listening. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. What does that mean? Well, it means that he lived in keeping with everything that God said. Josiah, I heard it said this way, and it may not have been this way at all. And somebody in Sunday school class might have said it this way, but said he and God went for a walk one day, and they walked so far that God said to Enoch, you're closer to my house than you are to yours. Come on home with me. That's us. You serve the Lord 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. And God someday will say to you, you're a whole lot closer to my house than you are yours. God help us to walk with God. One of the two men who did not die. And then there is that request of Elisha in connection with this event. As Elijah knows he's about to be taken up, Elisha says, could I have a double portion of your spirit? And Elijah said, if you can see me when I go up. And as Elisha went up in that whirlwind, they'd crossed over the Jordan. In fact, Elisha had taken that garment and had hit the Jordan River, and the river opened up. When Elisha came back, Elisha took that garment that fell out of heaven, out of the chariot. As Elijah was going up, he had Elijah's garment, and he took that same garment and hit the Jordan River, And he crossed the Jordan River and opened up the Jordan River. And then he went up. Not to where God was, but he went to be with the Lord. It's sort of like what Paul says. I have a desire to depart and be with the Lord. That doesn't mean, Paul was not talking about, I have a desire to go straight to heaven, because we know from the study of the rest of the Scripture, that's not what happens when you die. There's that unseen world called Hades. But if Paul was with the Lord on this earth, then whenever the angels carried his spirit to wherever the angels carry the spirit of the righteous, if he's with the Lord on this earth, think of how much more he'll be with the Lord in that other place. And so here's this great man Elijah. This great man Elijah who goes up. You start looking at all of this, and all of a sudden you'll arrive at the time when you read about Elijah being the forerunner of Jesus. It's interesting. We think about John the Baptist being the forerunner of Jesus, and that's exactly right, but there's a sense in which Elijah is the forerunner of Jesus. Look in the book of Malachi chapter 4. You read about the fact, in fact, it's the last thing God said in the Old Testament. Before I send my messenger, before the Messiah comes, I will send you Elijah the prophet, and he'll turn the hearts of the father to the children, the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with the curse. Now in Luke chapter 1 in verse 17, at the announcement of the birth of John the Baptist, this very quotation was made and applied to the coming of John the Baptist. He'll turn the hearts of the father to the children, the hearts of the children to their fathers. So God in the Old Testament had said, I'm going to send you Elijah before the Messiah comes. And that's the last thing God said in the Old Testament. You ever think about the fact that in that 400 silent year period between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament, for 400 years God did not say anything? You know what the last thing God said? When Malachi ends, you know what the verse says? If I don't send you Elijah, I'm going to curse this earth. And that's the last thing God said. No wonder when John the Baptist came in the spirit and the power of Elijah, the people listened to him. John did no miracles, by the way. And yet the people so believed that Elijah was going to come that when John the Baptist came, they really thought that God had fulfilled his prophecy. And he had. And that's what Luke 1:17 says about that. Now, in John chapter 1, when John the Baptist is preaching, they come and they ask John, are you Elijah? And John answers the question in the intent in which they asked the question, are you Elijah? And he said, no, I'm not Elijah. What do you mean? I'm not Elijah the person. I'm just the one who's coming in the spirit and the power of Elijah. Elijah, by the way, was a man who wore a garment, hairy garments. And so was John the Baptist. Remember his garments being made of camel hair and a leather girdle about his loins? That's the way Elijah was. And so all of a sudden for 400 years, God had said nothing other than, I'm going to send you Elijah, and if I don't, I'm going to curse this earth. And then all of a sudden out in the wilderness of Judea, there stands a man, John the Baptist, just like Elijah, preaching like Elijah. No wonder he had the impact that he had. But in John chapter 1, they said, are you Elijah? And he said, no, I'm not Elijah. But Jesus said, that's exactly who he is. And in Matthew chapter 11, he talks about John the Baptist and said, among them that's born of woman, there's not arisen an individual greater than John the Baptist. He that's least in the kingdom is greater than John. Kingdom had not yet come. John was not in the kingdom, but of everybody that had ever been born up to that time, from Adam all the way to that time, the greatest man that had ever been born was John the Baptist, the one who came in the spirit and the power of Elijah. And then he said in verse 14, and by the way, if you can receive this, John the Baptist was the Elijah, the Elias, the King James says, that was to come. Jesus himself said that John the Baptist was the fulfillment of that prophecy about Elijah. And the same thing after the transfiguration, whenever they come down, Matthew chapter 17, verse 10 to 14, the same thing. He affirms again that John the Baptist was that Elijah that was going to come. Now, what about the transfiguration? At the transfiguration, there are two characters that are there that serves to really answer the burning problem that the church was going to confront. And that is, what is our relationship to the Old Testament? You see, the Jews divided the Bible sometimes into three parts, but usually into two parts. In Luke chapter 24, it talks about the law and the prophets and the Psalms. But generally, they just simply talk about the law and the prophets. Who gave them the law? Where did the law come from? Oh, there's no question about that. That's Moses that gave them the law. Where do the prophets start? Who's the symbol of that individual who stands in the way that we've developed the lesson tonight? Who is the symbol of the first of the prophets? And so whenever they're there on the Mount of Transfiguration, there is the law and there is the prophet. The law and the prophets are there. Moses is there. Elijah is there. And Jesus is there. And then all of a sudden, Peter gets it all messed up. Let's build three tabernacles. Let's make Moses and Elijah and Jesus equals. That's Judaism. That was the problem when the church began. What do we do about Moses and Elijah? Go back to the Mount of Transfiguration, and God answers it. When Peter was saying, let's hold on to all of these, to the law and to the prophets, to Moses and Elijah and to Jesus, the cloud overshadowed them, and then Jesus alone was there, and God said, this is my Son. Listen to him. As great as Elijah was, as the messenger of God, he's nothing when compared to Jesus. Elijah, God's messenger. Not the one who caused the trouble in Israel, but this first of the prophets who stood there and stands as a man of like passion as we are. Marvelous character indeed. But he's not equal to the Son of God. And tonight you and I need to do exactly what Matthew chapter 17 and verse 5 and Luke chapter 8 and verse 36, 35 and 36 says, and that is, hear Jesus. The prophet of God is Jesus himself. And that's what we need to do tonight, is to listen to Jesus and hear the words of Jesus as they are proclaimed. What do they proclaim? You have to believe. You have to repent. You have to confess your faith in Jesus. And you have to be baptized. And how thrilling it is to see someone baptized. And we ought to make that one of the most exciting things that happens. We ought to make that the topic of conversation to our kids and our grandkids when we're going home. Man, wasn't that wonderful, that thing that happened in this building this morning. Soul snatched from Satan, delivered over to God. And that which happened in this building this morning can happen in this building tonight. And if you've never, as a believer, been baptized in order that your sins might be washed away, you can do it, and you can do that very thing tonight. Then He'll add you to His kingdom, to His family, to His body, to the church, to the house of God. And then all He asks is just do your best. Be faithful unto death, and I'll give you the crown of life. Faithfulness sometimes involves acknowledging sin. We need to be faithful and do everything we can to serve God. If you need to respond to this invitation, Jesus softly and tenderly pleads for you to come right now as together we stand and sing. Will you come?